This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 paved the way for the creation of National Public Radio. It formally began on February 26, 1970. NPR has come a long way since its early days, moving from a time when it was seen as alternative and experimental to the point today where it boasts the most listened to morning radio show in the United States.
Bill Siemering knows the early days well. The Wisconsin native was one of the guiding forces behind National Public Radio, serving on its founding board. And he later helped develop signature shows such as All Things Considered and Fresh Air. After decades in public radio, he shifted his focus to radio in the developing world, earning a MacArthur Fellowship in his efforts. Siemering was in Milwaukee not long ago, and he joined us in the studio to share some radio history. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
Why was radio first important to you?
It was first important to me as a first grader going to a two-room country school outside of Madison, Wisconsin, and listening to the Wisconsin School of the Air. So I learned science, social studies, nature studies, music, art, all by radio. From that time on, I've been fascinated by radio.
Do you still have the memory of those voices coming through the radio from—
I do. Yeah. I do. And interestingly enough, the teacher would always have a manual and know what science things she had to have set up or art things. So a number of them were women, which I realized later was not common in broadcasting. It was a wonderful way to enrich education in a country school.
Right. The country school never would have had access to all these kinds of lessons otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, the teacher was teaching three grades. Which is enough.
Well, how did that work? At a certain time during the day, the teacher would just turn on the radio.
Right. Twice a day, she'd turn it on, and she knew what was coming. And we would listen attentively and do whatever we were told to do.
So when you think about that time and how radio shaped you as a first grader, what of that time still shapes the way you see how radio meets its listeners today?
Well, simply put, I guess every time I turn on public radio, I learn something new. And I always think of radio as a source of information and of extraordinary intimacy at times. It's the most intimate medium, really, because it's a human voice. And people are free to engage with a host and open up in ways that they wouldn't in any other way. Television is not conducive to that with the lights and cameras and everything going on. So radio and the listeners are creating the images. Listeners are imagining what you and I look like now. And it's nothing like what we do look like, of course.
Well, and it's funny, even today, for as long as I've been in radio, and I imagine maybe the same for you, I still, to this day, get the images wrong in my head.
Uh-huh. Right. But I think that's part of the ownership the listener has with us, that they're imagining this.
And it goes without saying that we are both tall and very handsome. So there was obviously a little bit of time between first grade and the early days of NPR. What was your connection to radio between that point and the point that you arrived in Washington?
Mm-hmm. So I worked at I worked my way through the University of Wisconsin in Madison at WHA, at Wisconsin Public Radio. First as an engineer, editing tape and so on, and then on air as an announcer, interviewer, reporter, that kind of thing. And then I was in the Army. I taught school up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, and I was teaching school and working summers at WHA. And they got a call from somebody I'd had as a professor at Wisconsin that wanted somebody that had experience in radio and student personnel. And I happened to have that combination because radio at SUNY Buffalo was a club, a student club. It was off the air in the summers. They'd go on the air 5 in the afternoon. And So it wasn't a proper station. Anyway, I took that opportunity because it was a wonderful chance to develop something. He gave me a lot of freedom, not much money, but we had a lot of freedom to experiment, and that's the way I used that station.
You created it. This is the station where you created This Is Radio, is that right?
Yes, which became Fresh Air. We established a storefront studio in the heart of the Black community. This was during the 60s, and I was very keenly aware of the need for hearing from voices that aren't heard on radio. And so that all informed me in writing the mission statement for NPR that emphasizes the importance of celebrating difference and treating people with positive regard and to talk with many voices and many accents, because that's what America's about. And I wrote that because I was trying to make the transition from educational radio to public. And the words mean something. And by public, that means everybody. And so I was trying to differentiate it from commercial radio, from educational radio, from PBS that was already on the air, and to capitalize on the unique strengths of radio as a medium, and to reflect the issues of the day, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting. We're having this conversation in 2018. I would imagine that in the mid-late 60s, there were still plenty of people already at that point who were saying the days of radio are numbered.
Yes, yes. They were. And people would say, oh, you work in just radio? I mean, people never say that to a print journalist. Oh, you're just print? I remember there was some public broadcasting event. There were television people and radio. And it was before we were on air with NPR. And the TV guys were going through some clippings from the New York Times. They said, so, Seymour, what do you think the New York Times is going to say about you next in a year from now? I said, we're not programming for the New York Times. I was being a bit smart aleck about it. But I was, you know, I mean, we have just a very different orientation.
Well, and the irony is that today the New York Times is producing audio programs.
Exactly, exactly. Because this is the age of audio. When the New York Times does that, and when the New Yorker, which is kind of the preeminent print publication we think of, as the New Yorker Radio Hour, we know that radio is now, you know, elevated to a wonderful place.
Well, and I've noticed this phenomenon that I'm curious to have you reflect on, because I think this is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, we're in this kind of podcast-intensive media universe today, and, you know, there are some really good ones out there, and there are some nightmarishly bad ones, and plenty in between. But I can't help but think when I listen to them that this feels a lot like an earlier time in radio, that mm-hmm. people are wanting to make them for the same reasons that you and I got into radio, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right, and it's this wonderful storytelling. And with the volume of news that we have to deal with and you're dealing with, there's not the place for these more quiet, reflective conversations.
Where does your work in developing nations come in? What do you see as the relative importance of radio and audio in those places compared to, you know, what we kind of have the luxury of using audio for here?
Yes. So I'd worked, after I've been working in public radio, I worked with the Open Society Foundation for 10 years, and they worked in Eastern Europe and Africa and Mongolia. The idea there behind their work was, look, these people have not had democracy for 70 years. They need like a Marshall Plan. And so George Soros set up foundations all over in these countries to talk about constitutions, media, law, and health, education, the basics, you know. So that's how I started my work overseas. And I went to South Africa first in 1993. This was a year before the elections, because I met with people that were interested in reforming the state broadcasting, South African Broadcasting Corporation, which was like a BBC.
Right. But at that point, it was probably just a mouthpiece for the government.
Right. And so they wanted to reform that so people could be informed about the election. And there were others interested in community radio. And interestingly enough, when the government formed their licensing authority, they only licensed community stations because they thought in the first year, because they thought they would best serve the interests of democracy, because they speak in local languages. And sometimes stations broadcast in three or more local languages. And they reflect the issues and concerns of the people, just as you do this here in Milwaukee. You're out in the community talking to people, finding out what their needs are and interests are.
How far along on the continuum were they in being able to do that?
Well, it's in terms of the production and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we provide, in some cases, we usually always are working now with existing stations. One of our African trainers, Martha Zulu, begins her workshops by saying, "Why are we here to focus?" And it's a wonderful question. I also hear that is, why are we here on Earth? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? But it helps focus a station. Like, you know, are we just here to play our favorite music, or do we have a more serious purpose? So we now enrich the programming on climate change, on youth health, women's health, things like this. And we do this by always having African trainers. So we work with existing stations. We bring them together. We'll have experts talking about climate change in that country or a health issue. We give them a digital recorder and mic, and they go out and have a field exercise and then critique it so they polish their skills. Then we send them weekly bulletins on a topic, like how do you store water for drought or on malaria youth-friendly health services. And they, again, these come from there. It has the problem statement on one side and solutions and production tips on the other. So they can go out with little experience and do these.
When you do something like that, do you get a different sense of professional or self-satisfaction in what you're able to do versus, you know, shaping the various shows that you shaped in this country?
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful to see them take the initiative. It's a very different relationship. I just go over there on the first workshop sometimes. I've got a colleague that does the implementation and so on. But we have excellent African trainers, and they then go and mentor. They visit each station and mentor. But it's so satisfying to see the results where you change attitudes about talking about safe sex, for example. It's wonderful to see that impact of radio on people's lives.
No one there is saying, oh, you're just in radio.
No.
Is there a similar spirit in that kind of work when you experience a station at that stage to what the spirit was like in those kind of formative years for public radio?
There is some parallel to that. It's such a different environment, though. But they're using this wonderful, imaginative, creative medium. I mean, they produce little radio plays. I mean, no one's taught them that, but they do that with sound effects and everything. And that's what's so encouraging to see them taking this idea and making it their own.
When you think about where public radio was in the late 60s, early 70s, and you're developing, you know, All Things Considered in 1971. When you look at the soul of NPR from those days, what parts of that soul are most still in evidence in 2018? I mean, the building obviously looks a lot different.
Yes. I think it really reflects some of those core values. I mean, that we had in, because I think this is what you do with Lake Effect. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. So I think that's what you do with Lake Effect.
Life-loving is an underrated part of the equation, too.
Yeah. then I said, philosophically, time is measured by the intensity of experience. Waiting for a bus and walking through an art gallery may occupy the same time duration, but not the same time experience. Listeners should feel that the time spent with NPR was among their most rewarding in media contact. National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
Do you remember your surroundings when you wrote those words?
I wrote that on my dining room table in Buffalo, New York. But I'd been thinking about these things for a long time and trying to make the case for radio. As we began talking about how radio was called the hidden medium, there was some folks in television tried to keep radio out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because we were such an embarrassment, they thought. And, of course, we take money away from television, which is more important. So this was aspirational, but I thought it was also practical. So it was a wonderful opportunity. Now, a lot of stations, I think, thought we're going to be like the big guys. It's going to sound like CBS and NBC, and it didn't. So there was the first meeting of the public radio managers. I think it was about 2 weeks after we were live, and it was kind of a hostile crowd, I must say. They said, who are these people? They wanted to sound like, you know, we have a conversational style, you know.
They wanted to sound like Douglas Edwards.
Exactly. Right. They were very suspicious of, we were using music in the program. We had arts features, of course, because we were considering all things.
Well, and just calling it All Things Considered had to have been a radical change from the kinds of names that other news programs had,
right.
You know, the CBS Evening News.
Right. You know, and it was hard. I mean, there were some programs where, you know, there'd be a brilliant piece and something, gosh, awful that we'd be embarrassed about because we had a very small staff gathered together, some more experienced than others. It took a while to gel as a unit. It was in beta form for a while. However, a program that was aired in October of 1972 won a Peabody Award, so we did get it together.
Well, and it is something when a document that you wrote at your dining room table in Buffalo, New York in 1970 still holds the same relevance and importance that it did 48 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, Bill Siemering, it has been a real honor and a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed being with you, Mitch, very much.
Wisconsin native Bill Siemering was on the founding board of National Public Radio. He worked at NPR, WBFO in Buffalo, Minnesota Public Radio, and WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, he's a senior fellow with the Wincote Foundation, also in Philadelphia.